This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Financial Sense News Hour, and this is The Big Picture. For The Big Picture today, we have two interviews we're featuring. The first one with Dave Morgan on the difference between the metals in their real prices, metals, versus their paper prices, and then an interview with Don Cox. Gold's performance may be linked to rising cynicism and fear. So, Jim, you have it.
Well, since early February, gold has been on a rise. But lagging behind has been silver, which has raised many questions. Is the gold bull market intact? It hasn't been confirmed by silver. Well, that has changed recently. And joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. And Dave, you're looking at silver in like gold. It's been in a downtrend. But when gold really started to take off at the February lows, silver lagged. And I almost look at silver and gold as silver kind of like, it's kind of like the Dow theory where the transports confirm the industrials. We now have, at least in my opinion, it looks like silver is now confirming gold. I'd like to get your views on that.
Well, those are my words almost. I mean, I'm not accusing you of taking my words, Jim. Let me keep the humor going. But no, I have the exact same idea. In fact, to give credit where credit's due, Jim Dines is probably the first that basically came up with the idea, first place I read it. And I've been looking at this market for, you know, four decades, as you know, that there's a confirmation between the metals. And I was concerned. I think we had a brief conversation off record where I said, you know, I'm not convinced we're in a new bull market. Silver hasn't confirmed yet. And I was looking for that 16 breakout and, you know, the over my shoulder service that I do, which is, you know, people kind of like to have that assurance. I kind of know, but, you know, I tell them exactly what I'm doing. It's my voice and it's my charting methods. And I say, look, if we get three closes over 16, you can go long. And that worked out beautifully. And we're sitting, you know, above the $17 level today. People say, well, what's a dollar mean? Well, it depends. It means a lot relative to where the market was. And it's a confirmation that the gold market is, you know, a new bull is intact. So I'll probably be laboring the point, Jim, but well said, because these are things that are important and they do make sense and they give you greater probability. There's nothing in our business that's 100% sure thing. But when you have the Dow theory and it confirms, you know that your probability is a lot higher when they confirm each other.
And Dave, why has silver always been sort of the laggard? Even if we go back to the bull market that began in the last decade, you know, in 2001, when gold really started to take off, it was, you remember, then that's when we first met each other early on, silver would trade from 4 to 5, it'd get up at 5, the shorts would come in, knock it down to 4 at 4, and it traded sideways for a long extended period of time. Meanwhile, gold was going up, setting new highs. Why do you think silver many times acts as a laggard? Is it the industrial component?
Well, great question. And I'm going to not really take issue with you. I'm going to tell you a long story. When I first started trading seriously, I had several brokers, but about the third one I had was a real metals head. And this guy was able to retire in his early 30s. He'd made so much money trading futures. And what he taught me at that time was the whites lead to yellow. And if you go back at that point in time, remember, I've been in this market for 40 years. So, you know, it's not like we're talking the last decade. We're talking well before that. But at that time, Jim, actually, silver usually led. Now, I can make arguments on both sides. One, I'm siding with you at the current time, meaning the last two decades or so. But who bottomed first, silver or gold? Well, silver bottomed well before gold did, years before gold did. But on the breakouts, gold bottomed at the 252 level and broke out before silver broke out in September 2003. And, you know, there's this guy that taught Elliott Wave Theory to brokers in New York. I mean, this guy was pretty high up the food chain as far as technical analysis goes. And he used to call me on a pretty regular basis and said, my goodness, how did you get that? I said, I didn't. The market did. It had to break above the 555 level, and I'm predicting it's going to happen in September, and it did. But I don't want to make this about me. I want to make it about your question. So I've changed that the whites lead the yellow. It ebbs and it flows. And the reason why, you know, Jim, I'm going to give a bit of a curt answer. I really don't care why. I mean, probably because of the industrial component. But, you know, metals, I mean, people don't get the idea that metals are just well-regarded physical elements that people regarded as money throughout history. Now, is that true in today's world? Well, there's a few percentage of us that know that as a fact, but very few agree with us. We're in the 1%, so to speak. Nonetheless, it's probably because of the industrial component, but I certainly revised my view that the whites lead the yellow. It's certainly ebbed and flown and gone back and forth. What I do know is in the acceleration phase, you can almost bet for certain that silver overtake, which means you're going to get a higher percentage gain paper wise or dollars wise going into the silver or into the whites, but it's also more dangerous. So that's why I've always advocated a balanced metals portfolio, not just a silver only position.
You know, one thing that happened that I learned actually from you and also reading CPM Group is silver is a byproduct of a lot of mining. I think, Dave, you know what the figures are. I think it's what, 70 to 80% comes as a byproduct of mining, copper, gold. But something changed in the last decade. And as the bull market continued and the demand for precious metals continued, you had a new sort of producer in the marketplace. And that was you now had companies that were strictly building silver mines. Now, I know that they did very well in the last decade. Of course, now we can talk about what happened in the subsequent downturn. Can you bring us up to date in terms of fundamentals, in terms of we're still, I suspect, getting the majority of our silver as a byproduct from mining? But what element did the pure silver producers add? And have many of them gone out of business? Or are we looking at a smaller universe now where they consolidate? Can you bring us up to date what's going on with silver producers? Because that was a new element that was introduced in the last bull market.
Absolutely. And I'll add on to that. Backing up again to the last bull market, there weren't, you know, the exchange traded funds didn't exist. I mean, really, you had a couple of opportunities to invest in precious metals. You could go into some type of leveraged account, meaning futures or options on futures, or you could go in the mining shares. But now there's so many financial products. So a lot of the silver only or gold only opportunities that a lot of money managers gravitate to are the ETFs because you don't have the risks in mining. But that's not the question you asked me. So what's happened is very highly to leverage silver companies such as AG, the symbol being the symbol for silver, First Majestic. We had it on our list at $4. It's been as high as about 24 and down below that very recently, actually. Anyway, that company, although it was like 90% silver, it's almost an absolutely pure silver play and had higher leverage than the silver price. You really didn't see it trade leverage to silver as much as I would expect it to. In other words, knowing the math, knowing that it's almost pure silver, you would expect that it would reflect that reality. It did not do that except for maybe about 30% of the time. The other part of the question is what happened to all these companies that were near-term producers, had only been producing for a short time, or had good projects or economic at, let's say, $25 silver, $30 silver, where are they? A lot of them are gone. A lot of them are put on hold, and a lot of them just basically went into other businesses. I wrote an article, and I don't write much for the public anymore, but I said, are all the miners going to pot? And I meant it as a humorous statement and also an accurate one, because a lot of these smaller companies that were big on mining became marijuana-type stocks literally overnight. Now, this is the truth, and I'm glad I'm throwing some humor out there for everyone, because it's true. I mean, the whole Vancouver situation is one that I'll probably end up writing a book on in my retirement, and this is the time to really drill down there too far. But yes, there's been a consolidation in the industry. Your bigger, stronger companies, well-capitalized, that had pretty good treasuries, like your big, you know, Pan Americans, your First Majestics, those type of companies did M&As, mergers and acquisitions. They saw companies that were in trouble financially, had good assets, they bought them up. So there's some consolidation. There was some that didn't get into production and probably never will. And there's some that went by the by and by. So overall, I would say, to put it in a metaphorical terminology, we have shaken the blanket very much, and what's left up and standing now are companies that you can pretty much rest assured you're going to have a good time in a bull market investing in.
So given the fact that the industry is consolidated, that's humorous. So they've gone from, because a lot of those companies, Dave, you know, they were starting out small in production, 3 million ounces of silver, trying to grow to 5, 6, 7 million, kind of like the way First Majestic started. And then, of course, they built their production with acquisitions and the acquiring of new mines. But they actually went to marijuana. That's kind of funny. They're probably making more money.
You know? Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I actually stopped being invited to some of the resource shows because the main product, the main theme was marijuana. And that's really not something I know very much about. So I was, you know, I was kind of out of place and I wasn't invited. But, you know, things are strong in the resource sector now and I'm invited back to those shows.
So given the fact that the industry's consolidated, some of these projects have put on hold, Dave, let's also talk about the economics of silver. A lot of silver comes as a byproduct from copper. We know copper prices were hit pretty hard. The old saying, Dr. Copper, tells you more about the economy. What does silver production look like? Has it fallen as the prices come down, just like we're seeing in the oil industry? Oil rigs have been taken off the market. We know that, you know, U.S. oil production will be down by 700,000 barrels a day this year. Is the same thing happening in the silver market with what's happened to copper and other metals?
The Silver Institute, I think their number is 5%. You can look it up on the website, and I haven't got their World Silver Survey yet. It's due in about another week. Societe Generale has stated that they look at it, I think it's 2016 will be off, I think it was 4.5%, and 2017 it was like 9.5%. So they're looking at the base metal world, which contributes about 70-75% to the silver supply, falling off so substantially that it's going to impact the silver market by roughly 5-10% over the next couple of years. So yes, it does have an impact, and yes, it will affect the silver supply. Another one, it's, you know, a bit touchy because I read both Jeffrey Christian's work and the Silver Institute. And, you know, I kind of get to pick and choose because I'm independent of which number I think is the best number. And I am biased. I think silver is very undervalued, even relative to gold. Nonetheless, Jeff's numbers on the recycling have always been higher by far, actually, than the Silver Institute's. I tend to side with the Silver Institute's numbers because, one, there's really no photographic waste being recycled anymore. I mean, that used to be the biggest part of the recycling equation. That's gone away a long time ago. And on top of that, when you have low prices, the amount of silver jewelry coming in, you know, earrings, necklaces, broken bracelets, that kind of thing, is much smaller because there's just not that much money for it. So normally, the scrap supply, the true scrap supply, lowers with lower prices and heightens with higher prices. So I'm a bit suspect that there's really that much electronic waste that goes into the recycling bin, as perhaps Jeff indicates. I'm not trying to pick a fight. No one really knows. Jeff has got his estimate. The Silver Institute has their estimate. I have my estimate based on their two studies. But nonetheless, that's the way I look at it. So the point I want to make is very simple. The supply of silver has peaked temporarily. Now, whether it's the peak or not, if you read our book, The Silver Manifesto, I'd say no. We think that the peak in silver, like peak oil, if you want to get into that, is actually a few years out because, as we all know, uneconomic silver deposits at $15 silver become very economic at $35 silver. So that means there'll be more silver pulled up out of the ground. It's a very, very simple common sense idea. And we know of so many good silver deposits that are basically marginally economic now that could be robust projects, you know, a few years hence, if silver prices do what I expect, then the amount to where we get to quote unquote peak silver is, in our view, probably in the 2020 to 2022 timeframe.
So given that that's a ways out, the fact that silver has now started to move up, is this just, you know, people are looking at gold and saying gold has moved up, and then all of a sudden they're looking at silver, looking at some of these fundamentals and say, you know, now it's silver's time and now silver's playing catch up?
I think so. And I gave some pretty good thought to our interview coming up today. And you know, one thing I want to do is kind of just go back and visit some history for everyone, because I think it's important if they're a long-term silver investor, and even if they're not, because people cherish, you know, good knowledge, good fundamentals, and good analysis. And so if you go back to, like, you know, when we first started talking, Jim, you and I, Silver was actually in a structural deficit from 1999 to 2006 inclusive. So we had 16 consecutive years where you could make a strong argument that silver was in a shortage. Now, I'd also argue that, you know, supply and demand always have to meet somehow. And the way they're supposed to meet in a free market is by price. So if there's a short supply of something, the price gets bid up and up and up and up until, you know, they match. Regardless of that, we had roughly 100 million ounce deficit in silver for 15, 16 years. So in 1999, the above ground silver supply was 2 billion ounces. It was eaten away till 2006, and roughly the above ground silver supply was 500 million ounces. Since that time till now, Jim, we're back to 2 billion ounces again. So you might read Steve St. Angelo, SRS Rocco, and Steve and I are pretty good friends, and he does great work. But what he's looking at, as far as a deficit is concerned, is looking at what the mine supply and scrap supply is as total supply in a given annual time frame, and what the total demand is, including investment demand, and that is producing a deficit. In other words, the number of, you know, bought silver for whatever form, industrial purposes or investment, is greater than mined silver and scrap supply. No argument. But I think the better way to look at it is the way that Jeff Christian looks at it, which is, are stockpiles diminishing or are they growing? The answer is they're growing. Now, having said all of that, I really want to continue because it's important for people to understand this, especially if they want to make a sound investment decision. You might say, and I remember this, you know, I mean, I've been beaten up on this point a few times, believe me. It's like, well, why would I invest in silver if now it's not in a deficit? The reason is that the above ground supply is important for that fact only. The real fact you need to understand is where we are in the monetary system at large. If you don't understand that we are in basically something that happens very, very rarely, where there is a breakdown in confidence and trust in the entire financial system, and because of that, there'll be a run to gold, and as a consequence, a run to silver, and as you said earlier, Jim, probably after gold makes its move. Once gold starts up in a very strong way, it will drag silver up with it, and I think that's the way it'll take place this time. That is the reason. So the above ground supplies of silver and gold basically are greater than they would be, let's say, in the grain supply or cotton or cocoa or coffee or any other commodity, because they're money, and money has infinite purposes and also infinite demand. So the idea I want to instill in people is that it's not really a function of whether stocks are building or not. It's a function of really, from my very studied view, where are we in the financial system at large? Are we on the incline or decline? And I think basically, as you know, many of your commentators and all the work you've done for so many years has indicated strongly that, look, we have a debt crisis and it hasn't manifest fully yet, but it began in 2008 and we don't know exactly how it's going to unravel, but history teaches us it is going to unravel further. And where do you go in those circumstances? Well, I say you hedge. I say 10% is probably plenty for most people, and you just hedge your bet, and you say, look, you know, I'm playing blackjack, and the dealer's got an ace of spades staring at me, and I got a lot of money on the table. I'm going to take a side bet on this thing, and I'm going to make sure if he has a blackjack, I'm going to be okay. And that's what you do in the metals world. Now, if you want to go higher than that, that's your free market choice. But for most people, having that 10% position is going to be plenty, because if things go the direction I think they will, that 10% will do more than enough to make up for it.
Let's also talk about, Dave, you know, both silver and gold are monetary metals. In fact, silver has been more of a monetary metal when you consider that the average person, going back when, you know, gold and silver was coined for pretty much commerce everywhere in the world, the common people were much easier to afford silver, where the wealthy had gold. And if you take a look at the price of the two today, I mean, I forget what the ratio is, but we got silver at on the day we're doing this, $1,760, and we got gold prices that are over $1,200. I would imagine, Dave, there's a lot more people that can afford, let's say, a silver eagle or a silver round than there are people that can afford a gold eagle.
Absolutely.
So when you talk about these two, I know in the last bull market that everybody remembers, of course, there were some different circumstances that drove silver to 50. You know, we had the Hunt brothers that were trying to corner the market, and silver was explosive, getting all the way up to $50 an ounce. Gold did very well during that same period of time. Contrast that market to the market that we're in now, because number one, I see a couple things, Dave, is we have sort of paper silver and gold that competes. I mean, back in the 70s, unless you were in the futures market, you actually had to go out and buy. You didn't have ETFs like GLD, SLV. You didn't have, in fact, there were very few gold producers, and certainly rare was it that you even had a silver producer. You had companies like Agnico Eagle that produced a lot of silver, but unlike the pure silver companies like we had today.
Yes, we have now a plethora of financial products. I mean, to the point of, in my view, almost absurdity. I mean, the derivatives problem is one that is sort of the draconian sword that hangs over the whole financial system, and that's mostly interest rate derivatives. But the point is, as you said, there's a lot of paper, silver, and gold out there that didn't exist in the last bull market. And because of that, for a long time, and in fact, I wrote an article for your website a long time ago about manipulation. And basically, for a long time, the market doesn't really care if what's being sold is a naked short or a piece of paper, paper product that represents gold or represents silver than the physical metal itself. And that can only go on for so long. And of course, you get the argument all the time that, oh, well, they can do it this long, they can do it forever. The answer is they can't, because paper doesn't equal physical. Having said that, there's a convoluted trail. Because you can have a futures contract, and then you can have an options on a futures contract, and you can even have an over-the-counter derivative on that transparent option. I'm not trying to make this rabbit trail too deep. What I'm suggesting is that the more complex the system, the more chances that one small thing, that little snowflake that causes the avalanche that Jim Rickards is apt to say, is something that you really have to be aware of. So because of that, and having that knowledge, it's a very common sense issue. You basically start your precious metals portfolio with physical metal. And once that's accomplished, I really don't care what you do. I mean, if you want to speculate, the best way, in my view, and I've learned it the hard way, is actually to do top-tier, cash-rich, unhedged mining companies. They give you great leverage. They give you good bang for the buck. In other words, you usually get two or three times the leverage of what you get in a gold or silver up move. So if you get a 30% move in gold, you might get a 100% move in a good gold stock. When you get to the top of the market, that's when PEs become important in gold and silver companies. A good gold producer, like a Newmont as an example, would sell 35 times earnings. And, you know, if you're at $3,000 gold, you're going to have a pretty good dividend probably go along with your investment. And a good silver company, believe it or not, Jim, and I'm sure you probably well know this, would be like 50 times earnings. Again, it's the Coke Pepsi argument. They're both sugar water. Which one's better? I don't know. The market always values silver companies stronger than it does gold companies for whatever reason. So this is an idea that I think will do your listeners well to understand. You don't have to make these things complicated. In fact, the older I get, the more I want to keep it, you know, simple and elegant. I mean, buy real metal, pay for it, don't margin it, and get some really good companies. And if you want to have some fun, yeah, speculate a little bit. And you can speculate in ETFs. You can do futures, which I recommend against for almost everybody. But, you know, there's some interesting ETFs. There's two times, three times. There's the GDX, the GDXJ. There's a lot of them out there. But these are all competitors, and realize what you're getting. When you buy, you know, even my great aunt, you know, she's done something in the derivatives market, and she thinks she owns gold. I said, no, you own a paper product that reflects the movement in the price of gold. You don't own gold. Well, she'll argue with me that she owns gold, so I don't argue with her. What do I know? I'm just, you know, I'm her nephew. So, but this is what happens in some markets.
And Dave, I want to point out, so much of the metals market is moved by the paper market, the futures market, the options on futures, and even derivatives on options and futures. I mean, you can leverage 100 to 1. And so that a lot of that moves, the paper market moves a lot of the metals market. But one of the questions has always been raised, you know, a lot of the hedge funds, basically they're using the futures market as just a trading vehicle with leverage to it, which I think you recommend for the average person out there is not probably the best thing for them to do, because it could be very dangerous, as leverage is a two-edged sword. But let's talk about if you're thinking, well, I'm going to go into the futures market and who knows, let's say we have a debt crisis or another financial crisis, God forbid, like we had between 2007 and 2009, when we didn't know how stable the financial system was. If everybody that was in the futures market or a good portion decided like, okay, I want my silver delivered. We know, Dave, there isn't enough silver to make that delivery. And let's talk about what happens on a cash on a delivery. In other words, if you look at a futures contract, they could deliver not silver, they can deliver you cash instead.
Absolutely. It's in a rule book. A lot of people, you know, don't read the rules when they sign up for a futures contract or an options contract, being able to trade options only, for example. And this is well within the right of the CFTC's domain. They set the regulations and the COMEX is available to anyone that wants to participate. So what would happen is, as you said, Jim, settlement would be in paper and there would be no quote unquote default because in the view of the rule book, they're obeying the rules. Their settlement mechanism is something that you already agreed to before you even entered any contracts. So the reason that there's a lot of, let's say, discussion involving the derivatives market, especially around the metals, they're so emotional, especially silver, more emotional than gold. And this blurs critical common sense thinking a lot of the time because emotions get involved and people say things or write things that they really don't research that well. Regardless, I have nothing against someone hedging the futures market or even trading futures. I mean, I do it. But again, it's not for everyone. And know what the rules are. I mean, you can't go in and start pounding, you know, jumping up and down and saying, well, you know, deliver my silver. I paid for the full contracts when it's obvious from the get-go that you cannot, well, you could demand it, but you can't necessarily expect it. For example, I mean, we've done this before, but the most that you can take off any delivery month in silver is 1,500 contracts. That's it. That's set. That's in bold print, which is 7.5 million ounces. So even though there's like 35 million ounces in a registered category, let's say that we do the Poplava Morgan Fund and we buy physical silver and we only take it off the exchange and we push the envelope and we stand for delivery in every delivery month for 1,500 contracts. Well, let's just round it down to 7 million so I could do the math in my head pretty good. There's 35 million ounces in the registered category, which is all the available. Everything else is sitting there held strongly by investors resting in warehouses for disbursement later at higher prices. We'd run them out of silver in 5 delivery months. It's over. It's done. Do you think they'd let that happen? No, they're not going to let that happen.
So, Dave, as we take a look at this market now, we've now got silver breaking out, confirming the movement in gold. Fundamentally, or is it technically that's driving this market right now? I mean, negative interest rates are a clear winner for precious metals. So do you think it's the idea of where central banks are taking money that is driving this movement in metals, and especially now? Or do you think it's just, hey, this is a beaten down asset and this is a temporary move? So do you think this is driven by fundamentals or is this being driven by technicals in your opinion?
I'm going to take the easy man's out. I'm going to say both, but I'll elaborate. I think it's primarily by fundamentals. The technicals are very interesting. I think we can get to $18 silver before we get back under 16 or even 15, which I don't think will happen. What's so interesting, Jim, is the commitment of traders in silver is horrible. In other words, you know, if we were doing a show a decade ago when, you know, we first started or so, I would be like, wow, I don't understand this. The commitment of traders looks so negative on silver. There is such a huge short position. So silver's trading differently than I've seen it trade in a very long time. It's trading very bullishly and it's trading as if the physical market. And I want to make that clear because people are going to come back. Oh, I heard David on, you know, Financial Sense and he said, I'm saying it's trading as if the physical market is actually having dominance. Now, I need more data. I need to see more, and I need to see a washout somewhere in the somewhat near future of a takedown in price in silver, and it will come. I don't know from what level yet, and see how that washes out and where the numbers restack. In other words, when there's a huge sell-off, what does the commitment of traders look like? Because I have a hunch, Jim, it's going to look different. Again, I'm not perplexed. I mean, I've looked at this market for too many days and too many years. But nonetheless, I've got a sense that something is different in the silver market. And my sense of it is that something's going on physically, and it could be China opening up this physical gold exchange. I mean, silver's a subset. You know, I jokingly say, just think, imagine if India, who's one of the biggest nation states gold-wise, they hold a whole big hoard of gold, you know, put out to Reuters and said, we're trading our gold for silver. I mean, they couldn't do it. There's not enough silver out there to make that swap. But that's the idea. I mean, there's no central bank that holds any silver as a monetary metal. But you go back into the late 1800s, into the early 1900s, everybody was basically on a silver standard. It wasn't until the Anglo-American Empire wanted to get it to a monometallic standard from a bimetallic standard, where they basically made silver persona non grata. That's what the whole metaphor about the Wizard of Oz is about. The yellow brick road was the silver standard. Slippers that she had that she clicked, because it was all about the working class having real money versus the banking elite that had gold money. And when they once they got it to a gold only standard, it's only one step off into a paper only standard and the problems that we have today. So a little bit of financial monetary history for you at the end, Jim, and really appreciate being able to be on your show again.
Dave, if our listeners would like to follow your work and the things that you do, tell them how they could do so, please, as we close.
Well, I've rebranded to the Morgan Report because, you know, I've got that silver only moniker, and that's okay. Certainly it is my passion, but we've done so much. And actually, to be honest, I've made more money in a couple of the Molly type stocks and just basic resources than I have. And I've made plenty of money in silver. I'm not saying it's just, you know, one of my, if you went and said, what was the best trade you ever made? It's actually been in other resource stocks. But nonetheless, we do cover real asset stocks. And that's what the Morgan Report's all about. So we look for value across the board. Is it primarily gold and silver? Yes, it is. But we've looked at just about everything you can name. And then, of course, I do trade, and you get to look over my shoulder and see that. So if you're interested, go to themorganreport.com. Please pick up the free Riches and Resources. It's a great product. It's totally free, and it's a great educational tool. I'm very big on teaching. I want to give a lot of stuff for free. I mean, most of my speeches aren't about, you know, buying our subscription. It's about learning more about the financial markets and why, in this point in history, the precious metals are so imperative.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
An electromagnetic pulse, also known as an EMP, is perhaps the greatest existential threat to North America and modern electronic civilizations everywhere, able to cause widespread destruction and cascading failures in the critical infrastructures we so heavily depend on today. That is the warning given by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who is the executive director of the Congressional EMP Commission, who joins us today. Dr. Pry, the first question I want to ask you is, are we heading toward an EMP catastrophe here in the U.S.?
Absolutely, we are. It's as real as the sun rising up in the morning and as near to us as two North Korean satellites that are currently orbiting over our nation at the optimum altitude to do a nuclear EMP attack.
Wow, that's frightening. Okay, so from what you're telling me, it sounds like the threat has actually increased in recent years, given that there are two satellites now orbiting in the right trajectory, I take it.
And it's also increasing for another reason. Every 10 years, the semiconductor revolution, the microelectronics revolution, continues on its pathway, on its progressive positive pathway, producing better and better electronics that can operate faster and faster and at lower and lower levels of energy. You know, this is one of the things that has accounted for the great prosperity and the revolutionary developments in electronics that have made our lives better and made our country wealthier and more prosperous. But while this is going on, the very technological revolution that is feeding our prosperity is also making us more vulnerable, because as electronics get smaller and faster and operate on lower and lower energy levels, they also become proportionately more vulnerable to EMP. So you have both of these things happening. Bad guys are getting nuclear weapons and more capabilities to inflict EMP attacks. Mother Nature, We haven't talked about that yet, but the sun can cause an EMP catastrophe as well, and we are overdue for a geomagnetic storm for the sun. So the likelihood of that increases with every day that passes. And our vulnerability is increasing because the critical infrastructures upon which we depend for our prosperity and survival, as they actually improve, they are also simultaneously becoming more and more vulnerable to this kind of attack. To give you an example, when the nuclear EMP phenomena was discovered by the United States in 1962 during the Starfish Prime event, you know, the electronics of the day were basically vacuum tube technologies. Those technologies were over 10 million times less vulnerable, 10 million times less vulnerable than the modern electronics that we depend upon today.
Well, if you've been an investor in 2016, it looked pretty much like 2015. And that's until recently. We began the year with stocks falling, commodities falling. But since the early part of February, there's a new story in the market, and that has been the precipitous rise in commodities, most especially gold. Joining me on the program is my good friend Don Cox. And Don, I want to talk about your March newsletter that you did. And you had a chart of commodities. One was of gold, one was of copper, and the other was crude oil. Let's talk about the significance and what these charts are really telling us as investors.
Well, I think the fact that gold stocks are up 45% this year is just such an amazing thing, whereas the price of gold itself is only up 15.5%. So there's two parts of the story. One of them is that gold has been very strong, but the other is that the mining industry is getting its act together and will no longer be a profit destroyer in good times for gold. So those are two stories, one which is an industry is adapting to lower prices. And the fact that gold as a commodity has been the best performing one raises all sorts of questions. And I love reading the commentary in the various financial papers about this saying, how can this be? Because here we have negative interest rates in Europe because of inflation going to deflation. So why is gold up? And so they've been writing about this week after week. And finally, with the quarter coming to an end, they're going to have to be able to have to say, well, gee, it doesn't seem to be going away. Only yesterday, when Janet Yellen spoke to the New York Economics Club, gold, which had been fading, rallied very strongly on the suggestion that the Fed was not going to raise interest rates. Look, it was only 3 months ago that Stanley Fischer, the vice chairman and the man who actually managed the PhD theses at university for Mario Draghi and Ben Bernanke, okay? I mean, this is the genius there. And he said, yeah, we're going to have 4 rate increases next year. And here we are through the first 3 months of this year. And now what we're seeing is that the Fed is sending its speakers out to the four corners of the media to give us somewhat conflicting stories. Last week, James Bullard said, yep, we're going to be raising rates. And what Janet Yellen said was, well, we're going to have caution because the global economy is giving us concern. Well, the global economy is not an expression that you heard the Fed talk about much because they're concerned about the U.S. economy and U.S. unemployment. Those are the things that it's mandated. So I'm not being critical of the idea of the Fed thinking of its role as a preeminent international bank. But what it's telling people is that these people who have 1,000 economists backing them up and access also to secret information about what's going on out there, if they are this confused, then people might say, why should I be paying a near all-time high record PE for stocks if the people that have all this information are talking about the economy as if it's in dubious shape? And after all, this economic recovery has lasted for a while. So there's a long answer to your question, but gold, the fact that gold has done so well at a time when nothing else seems to have done particularly well, raises the question as to whether the fear factor is creeping in from the shadows. And we're not talking about the fear of Islamic terrorism.
You know, Don, you raise an interesting question. I want to talk about this year's presidential election, because if we take a look at the outside candidates, whether you're talking about Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, is gold's rise more of a reflection of loss of confidence in government? Because you just mentioned in December, the Fed was telling us they were going to raise interest rates 4 times. Then in March, they said, well, maybe only 2 times. And then Yellen gives a speech and says, we may even go slower. So you've got Europe that has negative interest rates. Japan, which has been caught in another recession, has gone to negative interest rates. There seems to be a growing lack of confidence that government can fix things.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I have not seen that kind of cynicism about government since the last year of the Nixon administration. And you recall how that ended. So, yes, there is deep cynicism. And the fact that Donald Trump can have a big lead in the Republican Party, and he seems to attack just about all the significant success stories in the Republican Party, whether they're running for the job or not. This week, he attacked Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Scott Walker was an absolute hero to Republicans across the land for standing up to public sector unions. So the fact that Donald Trump is attacking the Republican Party, as it has been, has a big lead in it, tells you that the cynicism among Republicans is great. Then, as you point out, we have Bernie Sanders, who honeymooned in 1988 in the Soviet Union, which was, of course, about to implode, but he didn't realize that. He thought it was a great success story at the time. And he doesn't seem to have learned very much since. So he's beyond radical. You can't call Trump a right-wing radical. All you can tell him, and after all, he refuses to have a collection of advisors. He says, I have a brain and I can learn what I need to know and make the answers myself. So he is closer to Louis XIV than he is to any particular politician here. So that is the kind of thing that does induce cynicism about governments. But then what we've seen with the terrorist attacks in Europe, that people are saying, what kind of governments do we have? The key killer in the latest bombings had been apprehended at the border when he was coming through Turkey, and they sent out a description on him to the EU, and they said, oh, no, he's okay. The only thing on his record was he was jailed for armed robbery, but no, he's not a terrorist, and they let him in. You would say, just a minute, this guy is coming in from Syria through Turkey. He's already been convicted and done a jail term for armed robbery. Of course, he was one of the big ones behind the Paris attack. We didn't know it. You look at that and you say, you can't make this stuff up. So what we're seeing is exactly what you're talking about, which is that the crash that occurred, which produced the Depression, the feeling was it was the big bad bonus bankers of Wall Street who caused it or weren't adequately supervised by government. Now what's happening is people are collectively saying, we don't think government is the answer. And the result is we're listening to loud voices of a kind that we wouldn't have given 5 minutes of our time to before. And so when you have a time like that, then they say, what can we believe in? So what happens? They're buying gold. So what this is an expression of saying, well, I know it was we got an 8,000-year track record for gold having its value, and we're not sure about much else anymore. And that, you realize, is extremely rare in all of American history. America is a land of optimism, even when things have been horrible, even during, let's say, the Civil War and the bad times of World War II. What you had was the American optimism, which was self-sustaining. And the question is that optimism disappearing? And if it is, then it's going to have an inevitable impact on the ability of American capitalism to outperform the world, because American capitalism is the efflorescence of American optimism, American belief that the next decade is going to be better than this decade.
Well, let's move on to another commodity, because one of the things that we've seen, Don, over the last couple of years is central banks tried to fight anemic economic growth and restarting the economic engine. They've gone to QE1. The Fed went to QE1, 2, and 3. We've seen it done in Europe. Now they've gone negative interest rates. We've got it in Japan. And one of the reasons is this anemic economic growth. Japan is in a recession. Europe's growth rates are barely close to 1% here in the U.S. I don't think we'll even hit 2% in this first quarter. So let's talk about the rise of copper. It's called Dr. Copper because it's supposed to tell you a lot of what is going on in the economy. In your opinion, why has copper gone up?
What copper did, first of all, it had been sold off hugely and heavily. And copper is essentially priced by China. China accounts for over half the consumption of copper in the world now. And so what the rally in the price of copper was the assumption in a lot of quarters that China was doing a good job addressing its problems. And remember, if it hadn't been for China going gigantically into debt for the next 3 years, we would have had a global recession depression after the big bad bonus bankers on Wall Street caused the financial collapse. So China bailed out the world, and we've taken the position that Atlas has shrugged, taking the thing from Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged, which is, who is it who sustains the economy? For Ayn Rand, it was capitalists. For the world, it was China. And so China was getting into economic difficulties. We had a tremendous stock market sell-off last year in China. And the rally in copper was an expression of the view that the economic numbers in China were starting to improve. So therefore, it was not a testimonial to the U.S. economy being better. It was a testimonial to optimism, somewhat short-lived, that China was getting better, because we've lost 20 cents off that rally on copper. It's subsiding again. So I look for signals like this, but the importance of them is that you keep looking at them to see if you're getting a confirmation of it. We've had a lot of bad news out of China since then, so the price of copper has retreated.
Copper is somewhat questionable at this time, so we don't know if it's really signaling that global economy or economic growth is to pick up. Let's talk about oil, because we saw oil hit a low of in the 20s, which I never thought I would see. Here we are on the day you and I are doing this interview. It's closer to $40. So is this a bear market rally, given the amount of inventories that are accumulating, or is this the beginning of something new?
As you know, because we've talked about it so much, back in 2014, we told our clients to get out of oil because there was going to be a collapse in oil prices, because the Saudis and the Sunnis were so upset about Obama's deal to get Iran into the world and get that $150 billion back, and also to eventually get a nuclear weapon. We explained that we believed that the Saudis and the Arabs were going to keep on overproducing to try to stop, first of all, the deal with Iran. And also, if it did happen, that Iran wouldn't have the cash flow, because Iran has the fourth largest oil reserves in the world. So, as you know, I've been talking about that in that period of time, and I simply said the price of oil will be set by the decision of the Arabs as to whether or not their policies, which were aimed at Iran, need to be sustained. And as long as they still feel that they fear Iran more than they fear their own people, who are, after all, struggling, because when 90% of your budget comes from oil price revenues and you drop the price by two-thirds by your own decisions because of your geopolitical views, the question is, how long can this be sustained? After all, if the Saudis and two other Sunni oil states announced they were going to cut back production by 1.75 million barrels a day, oil prices would stabilize. And if they said they were going to cut them back by 2.25 million barrels a day, we'd have oil at $70. And so it is strictly a political decision, just as when I came into this business, when Egypt and Syria attacked Israel at the time of Yom Kippur, because they thought they could beat them then when everybody was observing this sacred holiday, and the Arabs, with strong help from Richard Nixon getting weapons in, the Jews repelled the Arabs, and it was a humiliating defeat. And so to punish the West, what they did was quadruple the price of oil. They put an oil embargo on, and it took oil up from $5 a barrel to $20 a barrel, produced a global recession, a stock market crash. And then after 6 months, they decided, well, okay, we've demonstrated our power. Now what we have is a cash flow at these levels, which we've created ourselves, and we're going to now get filthy rich, which they did, because up until then, they were not powerfully rich. But when you quadrupled the price of your product and kept it that way, which they were able to do for some time, it worked out. So that's what happened back then. And I'm amazed that more people haven't gone back and looked at it and said, well, isn't this just the reverse policy? And they accumulated their trillions in assets at that time because of high oil prices, which they were mostly able to sustain. And now that they're looking at the fact that they can't seem to stop Iran, I mean, they, like others, when Iran started firing off intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Saudis thought, well, this will surely be enough that Obama will intervene and say that was opposed to in the deal. Say, oh, no, 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 that was not part of the deal. That was a side promise. And so what we've done is the right thing. We've had a resolution passed in the UN Security Council condemning them for doing this. They have fired off three ICBMs. The only advantage of an ICBM as an international force is if you attach a nuclear bomb to it. So they did that. And to the horror of the Saudis and the others, nothing was done except Samantha Power made a speech at the UN. So the question they may have is that the U.S. has gone totally mad on this, and so therefore what we've got to do is at least start improving our cash flow. I don't know, but it's quite obvious that as long as Obama is in power, nothing is going to be done to restrain Iran, seriously. And that's what the Sunni Arabs fear most, because Iran is a much better organized and educated society than are the Arab Sunni oil states. And also, there's a history going all the way back to Old Testament times of leaders in what was then Mesopotamia and so forth, that they were leaders who had power over the Middle East. So what I believe could happen is that the Saudis and the other Sunnis will decide that to continue to punish themselves by overproducing won't work. Yes, they justified doing this on the basis of U.S. frackers, because, of course, they're part of OPEC, and they're in the process of bankrupting some of their OPEC members because of their concerns about Iran. They had to come up with another, but that was quite obvious to everybody who looked at it, that what was their real motivation. They are scared of Iran, whereas we are being told, don't be frightened of Iran. Iran is a very civilized society, and they're just, we're part of the solution to the problem in the Middle East. So it's not likely that as long as we have Obama in power, that the Arabs will decide that it's time to get normalized oil prices. But they may just decide that they can't stand it any longer. What could accelerate it is if Putin, who realizes exactly how the geopolitics works, if Putin would enter into a deal where Russia would cut back on, say, 750,000 barrels a day. And with that kind of offer, maybe this time, then the Arabs wouldn't be asked to do the price fixing alone. But this is all speculation. The Shah of Iran said oil and politics don't mix. He didn't live long after he made that statement. Ayatollah Khomeini took over, and ever since then, oil and politics have mixed in various degrees. And $40 oil is a product of the Obama deal to give Iran what will eventually be a nuclear bomb in a period of 10 to 12 years. And the fact that they're moving so fast to create the ICBMs and to get advanced weaponry with the cash flow justifies the terror that these Arabs have of Iran. And so at some point, the Arabs are going to decide they need cash flow to be able to get themselves armed against an attack from Iran. When they reach that point, we'll see $70 oil. Not until then.
You know, it just kind of strikes me because we've heard, Don, that Saudi Arabia can produce oil for $4 or $5 a barrel. But when you think of their cost of running government and their social programs, it's close to $30 a barrel. And then if you take a look at Saudi reserves, the Saudis have had to go through $100 billion of their reserves to support government. And there's even talk of taking Saudi Aramco public. So now you've got the Saudis talking to Putin. And just as oil is very important to the Saudi economy, likewise, oil is very important to the Russian economy. And I can't imagine that either Putin or the king in Saudi Arabia wouldn't like to see higher oil prices. So does that make, and maybe this is what the oil markets are sniffing out, that there is likely, if prices remain low, there is some kind of deal between Russia and the Arab states?
Well, as I say, one of the reasons why it's been difficult to do a deal between Russia and the Arab states is Russia has taken advantage of Iran's cash flow. Russia has only two industries that are world-class: the oil and gas industry on the one hand, and advanced munitions. And so Russia has been prospering from the deal with Iran now, and Iran is buying high-priced Russian weaponry. So therefore, if they go on in a deal with the Arabs on this, the Arabs may say, and oh, by the way, you've got to cut back on your sale of arms to Iran. That may actually be the sticking point. It may not be oil. But what we know is that, yes, those Sunni states do not have functioning economies apart from oil. You're absolutely right. I've spent time over there, and all the stores and shops and so forth that you see there, what you have is they are all majority owned by local Saudi men, but they are actually operated by people from outside Saudi Arabia who are prepared to work 10 hours a day to make them function. And the deal is, I saw it actually happen in one of them, that sometime during the morning, the owner comes in for a cup of tea for half an hour, and then he leaves. And so what you have is this society, which is built obscenely on oil prices, and therefore preventing these people from developing as a diversified economy. So it's always been the temptation. They tried to diversify away from it. It hasn't worked. So I think what we're going to see is they're going to have to face up to it, that they've got to do this because the Middle East is in flames. And if they do that, then what we're going to have is what will be really good oil prices, and the frackers will be back in business here. But that's the point. As you know, I've been telling everybody who will listen to me for nearly 2 years now that that's what's going to happen to oil prices, that they're going to be low as long as the Saudis are frightened. And the reason I knew that was because I had been at a dinner with Prince Turki just the last night that he was ambassador to the United States, a small dinner. And he talked then about, when they talked about the Middle East, he said, oh, Israel is a nuisance. But he said, the only important thing is Iran. Iran must not get the bomb. And he said, if we see that Iran is likely to get the bomb, we will use all the forces at our disposal to try to head that off. Because if Iran gets the bomb, then every other nation in the Middle East will have to get the bomb also. And we have access through our friends to them, which meant, of course, Pakistan. But he said, what we know then is if the Middle East is awash in nuclear weapons, there will eventually be a nuclear war. So that was the policy announced then. That was 3 years before the imposition of this. So the only reason I can reveal the name of it now is because he appeared on American television. I saw him a few months ago, in which he reiterated those views. He, of course, is very high up in security in Saudi Arabia. So the reason I said that was because I knew exactly what their policy was, because it had been proclaimed that they were so terrified of what Obama might do on a deal with Iran. And the fact that it went ahead and all of this, and that so many people spent their time arguing about how many 100,000 barrels a day should be cut from production to stabilize prices, this was irrelevant, absolutely irrelevant. I was amused 2 weeks ago. There was an article in the FT by a strategist saying, well, as everybody knows, the reason why oil prices are low is because of the Arabs trying to head off the deal with Iran. That's the first time I can recall in the FT that anybody said that that was the reason. And the author begins the article by saying, well, as everybody knows, this is it. I burst out loud at the breakfast table over that.
Don, for, gosh, probably over a half a century, U.S. policy has always been to defend the Middle East as the world's largest shipping lane for the delivery of oil. We've always had carrier battle groups in the region, as many as two. And recently, we had none. In fact, the only carrier battle group in the region was the French. I think we've sent one back in there. What is the thinking of the administration in terms of not only giving the Iranians $150 billion, but really giving them access to eventually have nuclear weapons? And they're showing that they intend to move in that direction, especially as they build up and advance their ICBM program. And then they're also doing weapon deals with Russia. What is our thinking here in giving this smoldering cauldron that we see in the Middle East, whether it's in Syria and Libya, the growth of ISIS, and of course, the tragedy that we saw last week in Brussels, it keeps growing. It seems like our withdrawal is acting to encourage the Iranians, and it's also making the Middle East a more unstable place. What are we thinking?
What we're thinking is what Mr. Obama was elected on. He said he was going to bring the troops home. He did. The problem with bringing the troops home, it was an unpopular war, but the problem was that there was all that American blood and treasure spent to stabilize that region. And by taking out all the U.S. troops, what they did was created a vacuum in a region where at that time they said, because remember, he ran for re-election on the idea that Osama bin Laden was dead and Al-Qaeda was on the run. So he was reelected on the basis that his policies had worked. And he said, and all American troops are home. We brought them home as we promised. Well, sometimes, you know, if you're dealing with children and they say, what I want most is candy, you might say, well, for special treats, I'll give you that, but that's not going to be a candy diet. What happened here was that policy exploded. And of course, then when it wasn't Al-Qaeda, it turned out was our problem. It was ISIS. And as we know from the president's interview, as of 2 years ago, he said that was just the JV team. He considered them laughably incompetent. Now, obviously, he wasn't getting good advice on this, but he wanted to finish up his term as the president who had made sure Americans were not dying in the Middle East. And he's close to doing that. The problem is, as Louis XIV said, après moi le déluge, after me the torrent. And so Mr. Obama is actually having to experience some of this while he's still in office. Now, as you'll notice, when he was in Cuba, he interrupted the baseball game for 5 minutes to extend condolences for all the people that have been slaughtered in Brussels. So it did interrupt his schedule somewhat. But he's really still trying to say that his policies will eventually win out because they will kill each other off. I hope he's right. But what it looks to me is that ISIS is gaining ground across the world. And because of their ability to use the internet, after all, the San Bernardino people didn't have direct contact with ISIS, but they had contact via the internet, and therefore they were self-radicalized. Well, what's happening in Europe is these people are being directly radicalized, and with refugees pouring in to Europe from Syria, they're going to be multiplying the number of radicals in the Eurozone dramatically. And all this in the cause of humanitarianism. So we come back to where it all began. At a time like this, with all these things going wrong, what you want to have some exposure to is the only thing that has always, in any crisis whatsoever in history, has been something that you could use to protect yourself and protect your wealth. So gold is the bad news story at a time when it's not an inflation story. It's not a Chinese wealth story in baubles, bangles, and beads. What it is a fear story, which says we don't believe the governments at the strategy level can cope. You know, the police force in Brussels, one of its problems is they speak two different languages and they have trouble talking to each other. Can you believe that in a town? When you hear that, you say, well, why should we be surprised that we're having these things? Because the ISIS people are well-trained and they have that basic ingredient. They're not only prepared to die for their faith, they want to die with their faith because of what's going to be given to them in paradise. You cannot protect yourself against a killer willing to die in the attempt to kill you. That's a fact. And so, therefore, we're going to have more incidents like this. And I think all of this has a negative effect on financial financial markets generally. The Eurozone was on its way to some kind of recovery. And remember, the Eurozone is a somewhat bigger economy than the United States is.
So, Don, outside gold, and we've seen that gold stocks are up 45%, probably the number one performing sector this year. Gold prices are up. We talked about copper being up, oil being up, the geopolitical ramifications. Outside of owning some gold, and I imagine you wouldn't recommend owning more than 10%, what else would you be doing in this kind of market? We spent the first 2 months of the year going down. Then we had Japan going to negative interest rates, Draghi coming out with double bazookas, and the Fed going dovish. So in this environment, would you own stocks? If so, what kind? Where would you be putting money?
Well, the answer is you got to own some stocks. I would suggest that you concentrate with defense stocks because the United States still has the most sophisticated, large-scale, and legal weapons industry in the world. So that's an industry which once again prospers from bad news or the fear of bad news. And so this is something where America's, you don't have to worry about tariff barriers or other things against American technology. These countries will love to buy American armaments. So I think that you've got to look at that sector as being one that you've got to be involved in. Beyond that, it is not clear from all the terrorist disasters we've had and everything, that the economy actually stops. I mean, you know, 220 people get injured or killed, but Brussels still, 2 days later, opens up and people keep on going. So therefore, there will still be economic activity. And it's not as bad as it was being in London during the Blitz, because the economic activity there was dramatically reduced. So I think, as President Obama said, you know, why are Americans so concerned? There's more problems in the United States from being injured in bathtubs than there is from terrorism. And that's factually accurate. So I think you have to say life is going to go on, but the multiple on which you should be prepared to pay for stocks should be reduced when you know there are going to be more terrorist attacks, more shocks, and more examples of governments demonstrating total incompetence. So therefore, decide what the appropriate multiple is. This is a case of buying good stocks where you don't have to overpay because other people are selling because they're in despair. Despair is never a useful emotion.
Well, listen, Don, very useful advice. It is rather interesting when you compare the charts and take a look at what's happened to copper, gold, and oil, that these commodities are definitely telling us a story somewhere out there that we've got trouble ahead of us. In the meantime, if our listeners would like to follow your work, Don, how could they do so?
We do our work through coxadvisors.com, and it's COXE, and we do weekly conference calls, and we do quarterly journals. So all you have to do is look us up, or you can look me up, Donald Cox, and you'll see how you get to accessing Cox Advisors. And what I've talked about here is what makes us different, because we've started out by saying that it is a true strategy firm based on the fact that I'm an historian by training. And when we set up in business, we said we believed that there was going to be more geopolitical risk in the next few years than there had been in the previous 20. And we said that's what we're ready to help people with. Unfortunately, that forecast worked out.
And unfortunately, it's still playing out. Well, listen, Don, as always, my friend, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
You too. Nice talking to you.
You know, that was an interesting interview. We've been doing a number of them. If you're listening to this on the premium channel, it'll be played on Friday. And then on the weekend show, I interviewed Jim Rickards in his new book called The New Case for Gold. There are a number of books out there that we're going to be talking about in the weeks and days ahead. One of them is The Only Game in Town, Mohammed El Arian's book about central banks. And the other one by former head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, called The End of Alchemy. We live in a world where we're seeing rising geopolitical risk, rising financial risk with derivatives, increased leverage in the system. Central banks have been printing money furiously, copious amounts, whether it's our own Fed, the ECB, or the Bank of Japan. And we're now moving to negative interest rates. We have them in Europe. We have them in Japan. And maybe someday soon, we may have them here in the U.S. And that is something you need to protect yourself against. But once again, All of the authors that I've interviewed over the years and the decades, when it comes to gold, do not advocate more than 10% in your portfolio. So if you understand why you want to own gold, don't get over-allocated. You never put all your money in one basket. The same applies for gold. But if you don't have any insurance out there, it may be a good time to pick some up.
Don't forget, everybody, coming up Monday, Lifetime Income, we're going to feature a program on learning online. People are actually earning major degrees rather than physically attending a university. They are doing things through the internet. Well, Jim, as we're looking forward to the weeks that are coming, here we go again. I mean, let me pull out the old script. This is from last year. In June, is the Fed going to raise interest rates or not? I can read my scribble from last year. That's what it sounds like. So we're.
Yeah, I know. If we look at the futures market, the probability of a June increase is looking roughly today about 15%. It's the same thing as last year. I mean, you're right, John. We could be repeating the same thing. Data dependent, that hasn't changed. Problems overseas with international growth, that hasn't changed. And, you know, what are they going to do? Data dependent. And the market's saying, probability is only about 15%.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we keep seeing, I mean, we keep seeing evidence and evidence. We'll probably pick up on this next week where we do more extensive coverage of what's going on economically. We're seeing more and more signs of economic weakness. And it was amazing because I was watching one of the financial channels, and the first mention I have heard so far of the R word, because we got GDP growth, it came in roughly about 0.5%. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And so corroborating evidence, and this is maybe that was the reason why Obama called Janet Yellen to the White House and say, hey, you know, things aren't looking too good, and we don't want them looking bad when it comes to the election. So probability of June, John, looks very, very remotely. About the only way I would see a June increase if we had one heck of a stock market run from now going all the way into June, where the market's at 2,300 and, you know, stocks are going up every single day, then the Fed would feel more comfortable raising interest rates. With things as wobbly as they are and things weakening, I can't believe that somebody at the Fed is not looking and seeing the same data that we see in our firm. If we're seeing it, you kind of wonder what those guys are looking at. So anyway, probability in June, it's not looking that great.
Not only that, we're in the middle of earnings season here, and the earnings are looking like, yeah, okay, whatever. They're not looking very good.
I mean, no. The earnings have not been stellar. They've been missing on top-line growth, missing on bottom-line growth. Of course, they're beating estimates, but, you know, that's a game we play every quarter. They lower the expectations, and then they come in and they beat the expectations. Nothing new there. But the trend is more important, and earnings are starting to decline, and that's the bigger picture. Anyway, speaking of the big picture, that concludes this week's Financial Sense News Hour. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.